Welcome to the Donna Sebo Show. Donna is an international mental practitioner, psychic, award-winning author, counselor, speaker, teacher, and radio television talk show personality. She brings to the airwaves talented people from around the world who share their insights and experiences with you, the listening audience. Now, let's join Donna.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to an hour of mind power. This is Donna Sebo, and today we're going to be discussing a subject that I don't know of anyone that hasn't been touched by it. I call it the big C, cancer. What is it? Where does it come from? What is its source? Why is it that it is becoming too common in the lives of people? How much has it grown, not diminished? We all see these various marathon runs, the image of the pink ribbon, all of this, it's out in front of us. It's really quite a subject matter. We hear all kinds of different points of information, and my guest today has put together a book, which I have to tell you is a real profound read, and it causes a lot of questions, and it causes one to think, how much do we really know, and are we going to have integrity enough to really deal with some issues that lie at the heart of a disease that has many different faces. Malignant, how cancer becomes us. Lachlan Jane is my guest. I want to welcome you to the show, Lachlan.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure.
Lachlan, before we went on air, I mentioned to you that I had a very dear friend that just died in the last couple of weeks of a brain tumor, cancer. And I've known this woman, this beautiful soul, for a number of years, and I heard her stories about what she went through, various treatments, and I'll never forget one day when she said to me, before she made the decision to go through some of the treatments she went through, I'm terrified. I don't know what to do. She became involved in a study. At one point in the study, what occurred to her is that she was given a dosage of, I think it was chemo, that was for a 240-pound male in his 40s. This was a woman that was a little bit over 100 pounds, and she was in her 70s. That put her whole body into a tailspin. When I got your book and I was reviewing this, going through it, I just thought there are so many people there, out there in the world today, they're terrified. They hear the word, the big C, cancer, and they become paralyzed. Thinking, rational people will say, use me in any way you can, I don't want to die. Tell us your story.
Well, that was one of the things that I noticed too, particularly when I started to look at the history of cancer and the history of cancer treatments, because cancer has always been shrouded in mystery and the feared disease to the extent that people couldn't even really admit that they had it until the mid-1970s. In fact, well into the 1960s, doctors wouldn't even tell patients oftentimes that they had cancer. And in a way, this provided a kind of horrific opportunity for medical experimentation to have a group of people with cancer, on whom any horrible treatment that they could think of could be conducted seemingly within some kinds of ethical boundaries because they were going to die anyway. So you had injections of plutonium. You had massive doses of radiation and so on. And so there is this kind of history of cancer treatment being tied up with other areas of science and with the military, most certainly, that has, I think, added in a way to the fear about the disease, and yet because that hasn't been so much the story about cancer, that's been a kind of hidden mystery behind cancer, we're left with a hangover, we're left with this idea of this horrific disease, and it is in itself horrific. People die from it. And you add all of that history and the terrible treatments, and you get this swirl of anxiety and fear and illness and horrible treatments and bodies going through this incredibly slow, often, and painful death in ways mm-hmm. that we don't see. I don't want to say we don't see enough of, but in a way we don't. We want to hide it. And that's why, that's one of the reasons that I've written this book.
Well, you have done such an intense amount of research. I just think of all the studies that are being done, and you go into the way different studies are. And I can remember my husband years ago telling me, because he was a business major, he said, statistics can always be manipulated. In fact, that was the first thing that was said to him in his statistics class. And going through your material, that is something that was very evident. But you were diagnosed with cancer. Tell us about your journey. Tell us about why you decided to be someone. I mean, you were going to be really aggressive about the treatment. You didn't care. You got involved with something called the Red Death, which just those two words are horrific. They remind me of Edgar Allan Poe's type of stories. What was it that happened to you?
Well, I was like many young adults. We consider in oncology young adults between the age of 20 and 39. And like about three quarters of young adults, I was diagnosed with a late stage cancer after having been told that, you know, my symptoms were nothing to worry about on several different occasions. And so by the time my cancer was found, and thank God it wasn't, you know, metastatic, by that time, you know, they basically told me the treatment. And even though at the time they told me, you know, the statistics, and which for most cancers, chemotherapy and radiation increase your survival rates by only about 5 or 10%. So it's very small.
Right.
But at the same time, when you're in that situation, you know, you just think, well, it's worth it. There's nothing else really that can be done. And at the same time, you look at the studies and you think, well, why haven't studies been done that use smaller populations so that we'd have more accurate data on which populations benefit from which chemotherapies? And so on. So you get to see the research also in a very different way. I think I thought it was much more organized and detailed before I went into that, you know, the cancer complex than I found once I was there.
Mm-hmm. So you said you found, because you ended up going through a malpractice suit, that there were 3 years of missed diagnoses. And this is something that I think becomes very frightening when you see these points of information, and they're not publicized. They glamorize all kinds of things. I watch stuff that's put out on television. Oh, look at this. This is the way it is. I look at so many scenarios that I have watched in my life with different people, including one of my own that happened many years ago. And I look at what's out there, and I go, my goodness, why do we prey on fear so that we don't look at a different way of working with things? And you have a sentence in your book. You say, I couldn't see a way to admit that three pieces of paper so utterly wrecked me, and at the same time auditioned for a strong character role within the medical performance, unless the patient should be a respectable, full-fledged member of the team, not merely a victim of circumstance. I know for a fact how difficult it is for anyone that does any malpractice suit. I mean, it's just unbelievable. And your statement in the book is that most juries will go for whatever a physician says, because it's the scientific, quote-unquote, positioning. And I like to think that maybe there are going to be bigger groups that are going to look at people like yourselves and others that have gone through a system that really, really is so inefficient. And look at what we're going through today. People are in a paralysis. We've got people that can't think their way out of a paper bag when it comes to dealing with health care. And here we have this scenario that people are being faced with every day. And it's just a real upsetting situation. Now, with you, you had 3 years of misdiagnoses. How were you able to work with this? And did you keep a paper trail? What did you do with this?
Well, I think I think medical error and medical misdiagnosis are just a really interesting place to see some of the many gaps in the system in which patients get caught up and end up spending so much time and energy and so much of their health ultimately, because medical error is a terrible problem, anywhere, but especially in the United States, because people, once they have an error, made on them, end up stuck holding the bag with extra expenses and time off work and so on, whereas in other places, at least, there's often health care available to them for free. And so we've set up this system of medical malpractice law that historically was set up to help doctors. It was set up to recognize that, doctors are people too. Doctors make mistakes. And that's okay. It just means that their patients shouldn't have to pay for those mistakes on their own. So there was a system set up, a kind of, insurance system, basically, for
patients. Back in the 1800s, wasn't it?
And it also meant that doctors would not be charged criminally when they made a mistake. So it set up a civil system to protect them. But what has happened is the insurance companies have got involved and, I think to a large extent publicized the idea. And also, of course, the law has that antagonistic aspect to it at the center, where the patient and the doctor, who at once, at least in one's imagination, were on the same side, working in the health of the patient, suddenly are on opposing sides. And so doctors feel, naturally, they feel blamed. And they feel like they've made mistakes that are in the course of their duty, and they shouldn't be blamed in this way. And, that doctors are a very powerful social organization, and they've been able to, with the insurance companies, erode patients' ability to sue. They've made it very difficult to get awards. They put caps on awards that are very low, so it's hard for patients to get lawyers. And so as a result, very, very, very few patients who've had medical errors practiced on them have even opted to sue. And at the same time, nothing has arisen to take the place of that. And so we're in a situation now where some doctors are now doing research on this and finding that, in surgeries, as many as half of all surgeries have some major error performed in them. Some doctors say that it's the third largest, medical error is the third largest cause of death in the country. So it's a massive problem, but no other way of looking at it than medical malpractice law has really arisen to take its place. And so so patients are left holding this incredibly expensive, painful bag, and we need to think of better ways and have patient advocates working on this problem and get doctors on board.
I have to tell you that there is a physician that with his patients, he has told them, when you go in for surgery, make sure you have a permanent marker and say, operate here, and mark on your body where the operation is supposed to occur, because of the fact that surgeons, and he was a surgeon, that this is something that he found, that many times people that were assigned to do surgery, they may or may not even know the patient, and they do it in the wrong place. He brought it across in a humorous way, but he wasn't kidding.
Doctors have, surgeons have, some of them are just starting out. They have to do their first surgery on somebody, right? And it's a dismal, horrible situation that we desperately need ways of better redressing.
Right, and accountability is extremely important. And I, my goodness, that seems to be the biggest thing that's coming out on so many levels in today's world, being blasted all over the airwaves, accountability, period. Well, when it comes to wellness, we have to be accountable. But people aren't sitting out on a corner saying, gee whiz, I would just be delighted to have cancer invade my body. That's not it. Now, one of the points of history that you bring out in your book, Malignant, How Cancer Becomes Us, was how chemotherapy developed because of mustard gas. Now, that was an insidious, hideous chemical. And I had something I came across not too long ago regarding the deaths that that caused and the horrible physical effects. Give us a little bit of that history.
Yeah, so in World War One, some physicians happened to recognize that the man who had been killed in the battlefield, who of mustard gas poisoning, had their lymph systems had been terribly affected, and they realized that at a certain point that cancer is a disease of two quickly dividing cells, and so the idea was if you kill all of the quickly dividing cells in your body, which includes, you know, the lining of your gut, your hair follicles, other quickly dividing cells, it might include also the cancer cells in your body. And so that is still the philosophy, the medical philosophy behind chemotherapy today, although they've tested many different kinds of chemicals. And so in the 1960s, hematologists, doctors who study blood, began to really work with this theory on children with leukemia. This is one of the reasons that what they call liquid tumors are so much more successfully treated than most solid tumors. And they underdosed kids, they overdosed kids, they tried different kinds of chemicals through the 1960s, and were actually able to come to a point where childhood leukemia is now one of the most treatable cancers around. And unfortunately, they haven't had the same, you know, quote, success with other kinds of cancers, but that hasn't stopped people from trying, because it has seemed for the last many decades to be a promising treatment. So one of the things I'm looking at is, you know, we learn in these trials of these chemotherapy drugs that a cure is just around the corner. We've been told since 1907 that a cure is just around the corner. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the ways that a lot of the questions I'm trying to get at, I think, are deferred as, well, they're not important now because once we cure cancer, we won't have to think about them. But I'm saying, you know, we've been saying this for decades now. So let's stop thinking that a cure is just around the corner and really look at the situation that people with cancer and those who treat them and those who are affected by it, which is all of us, are affected by the disease. What does the disease mean then, given that we don't really know that much about it? How do we then understand something that is killing so many people and yet we don't really understand what to do with it, what it means, how to treat it, and so on?
Now, the industries that have grown out of this have just been phenomenal. And you make a statement, I'm quoting directly from your book, cancer is our history, cancer has become us, and it's embedded within this country's key industries, medicine not least among them. Cancer treatment is a multi-billion dollar business. Most people don't hear this. Cancer has the highest per capita price of the nation's medical conditions. It's beyond the heart. And they said, you make a statement here. If one wonders why we would extend the life of a pancreatic patient for a dozen days with a $16,000 drug, let us remember that this money does not evaporate after 12 days. It continues to circulate in stock prices, salaries, and smaller crumbs of an infinitely profitable cancer pie. So cancer fills the core of so many economies that if a cure were to be found, the economy might crash. That is a fascinating statement to me. Absolutely fascinating. And healthcare has become the most profitable industry in the economy. And that is something that I don't think most people are really aware of. And you go into information on the pharmacy and all kinds of details regarding people's health situations. I know many individuals that have had to declare bankruptcy because of healthcare costs and treatments. And this is something you bring out. You bring out collection agencies call 46% of cancer patients in the United States. You were one of them. Collection agencies were contacting you to pay the bill. This is a heavy statement. This is really important information. How did you manage that?
Well, I mean, I think that you're right. You know, the profit in the cancer world, and you know, I talk about profit made in both causing cancer and treating cancer, is one of the kind of unspoken and, you know, unanalyzed aspects of all this. Because after I did the research, I sort of came to the conclusion that it would be that we're stuck in a really awkward position here, where corporations make so much money, producing the chemicals that cause cancer, and trying to stop regulation of known carcinogens in pesticides and gas and plastics and you name it, and keeping on creating this idea that we don't really know if it causes cancer well after the data's in, that we know well enough that we could regulate some of these chemicals. At the same time, we can't forget that the pharmaceutical companies and the hospitals and so on are making tremendous amounts of money from treatment. Now, that doesn't mean that individual doctors are bad, or mm-hmm. that anybody means to do ill, or that the CEO sitting in his or her boardroom means to cause people pain. But it does mean that we have a disease that circulates in wildly different ways in different kinds of debates. And so we often hear, oh, cancer's terrible because it's costing us so much money. It costs individuals so much money. It costs our culture, you know, so much money. But in fact, yes, that is very true. And that is one of the reasons that it's not so great. But you have to also recognize that it also causes this profit. And so people have investments in, literal and figurative investments in cancer. And that affects how research is done, what research is done, how people formulate different questions. You know, cancer treatment is also a huge industrial program with massive, you know, radiation treatment centers. And it's big technology that requires a lot of different people and areas of expertise that put it all together in the way that we understand it. So if there's something wrong with the way we understand it, and there seems to be because, you know, the survival improvement rates have been so low, it's going to require really a revolution in not only thinking, but in the politics of organization and in the science and the technology around it. And each of those have streams of producers of the, you know, of the technology and education and areas of expertise. So, you know, to bring that down to the kind of more individual question you're asking, as patients, we get stuck in these because, you know, I phoned my oncologist and my insurance paid about 60% of the bill. So I phoned the office and I said, you know, how much will this cost my visit? And they said, oh, about $1,000. And I said, okay, well, that's fair enough. And then I got my bill and it was much, much higher than that because, you know, they didn't really know what it would cost. And then they sent my records to somewhere and they billed me. And so I had all these bills and they didn't accept that my insurance, that I had paid the deductible already, and so it was a massive debate with the insurance company. And, you know, they have the collection agency on their side. I have nothing on my side except the hours that I can devote to being on the phone when I'm sick, you know. So the deck is stacked. The deck's stacked toward them. And the person on the other side of the phone doesn't mean to cause me ill or whatever, but it's the system that we all play a role in that makes it so difficult to not only be a cancer patient, much, much more difficult than the actual treatments and the disease, but also to see the broader, these broader things that frame the disease.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely true. Now, you go into, and I want to ask you now, would you stay with me for an additional 15 minutes?
Absolutely.
It's going to be coming. Wonderful. I'm delighted that you're going to be able to do it. For those of you just tuning in, Malignant, How Cancer Becomes Us, Lachlan Jan is my guest. Now, Lachlan, you have in this book, and I'm going to sidestep for just a minute, most of the time when we think of cancer, we think of women. We think of breast cancer because that's the most publicity. We think of the marathons, and we relate to the many women that we've known, and I've known so many, that have gone through such difficult times. And I was really impressed with Jim Fontella's story. And this story is, I think, so important. And I want to bring up a point that testicular cancer has increased 75% since 1975. Central nervous system cancers have doubled for those aged 65 and older. The incidences of cancer for those aged 1 through 19 have increased by 19% since 1973 to 2002. Thyroid, rectal cancers are increasing. Something's really wrong. Something's very, very wrong. Now, I know we've got larger population numbers. I've heard people say, oh, we've got more people than ever before. That is true. And it is true that we are more aware of this than ever before. But Jim Fontella's story is quite a powerful one. And when we come back, I want to talk about this because we do need to pay attention to what's going on in our environment. We need to pay attention because it affects us and every living thing around us. My guest, Lachlan Jan, we're going to be coming back with her and continuing in his story because Jim Fontella, a Marine, his story is quite a powerful one. We're going to be back in just a moment.
Do you have a group, organization, or club that would like to have an interesting and dynamic speaker? Then you're going to want to have Donna speak to your group. She motivates audiences towards personal empowerment, giving them tools for their personal and professional success. If you would like Donna Sebo to bring a presentation to your next event, call Delphi International at 253-582-5604. That's 253-582-5604.
Amino Muscle Snack Time, the chewable nutrition that feeds your muscles. Amino acids are the building blocks of protein. When you exercise, muscle tissue naturally breaks down. This low-cal, chewable snack helps to reverse that process and won't pack on the pounds. You can chew a few tasty vanilla tablets or any one of their other flavors before or after physical exercise, right before bedtime or first thing in the morning to jumpstart your metabolism into gear for the day. Convenient to carry in a purse, backpack, or briefcase, they are a tasty snack for the person on the go. Firm, fit muscles, trim, healthy body. Sound good to you? Check out Amino Muscle Snack Time Chewable Nutrition by going to Amazon.com or SquatSponge.com. Tone up, trim up, and nourish your body to the fitness level you desire. Amino Muscle Snack Time Nutritional Tablets. Check out the information and order today. Go to Amazon.com or SquatSponge.com. Order now.
Hi, this is Donna Sebo. Welcome back. My guest today is Lachlan Jan. Her book, Malignant, How Cancer Becomes Us. This is so important. This publication is so important. If you know of anyone that has had this experience, if you've lost a loved one, if you are frightened by the big C, cancer. Being informed gives you an opportunity to think through your choices that you can make. But let's go back, because there's a source for cancer. Cancer has many different faces to it. It's not just one thing. I remember being told that there's like 600 and some odd cancers, if not more. And that's quite incredible when you think about it. But it's a very adaptive, mutated cell. And it can, everybody carries it in their body. There isn't a living form that doesn't have it. So what is the trigger that activates it? Why is it that this will suddenly attack organs in the body, metastasize throughout the entire system, go into the brain? What is it? What's at the core of this? I'd like for you, Lachlan, to tell about Jim Fontella. He's a Marine. And what happened to him and a large group of men?
So Jim Fontella lived at the Marine Corps base camp in a place called Lejeune in Jacksonville, North Carolina, which is believed to be one of the largest water contamination sites in American history. So between 1957 and 1987, nearly a million people were living on this military base, and they drank water and bathed in this water that was found to contain chemicals in concentrations that were, you know, by current laws, hundreds of times those that would be permitted now. And Jim Fontella got breast cancer and is, in fact, at the center of one of the largest male breast cancer clusters in the country. Now, one of the interesting things about this is that he posed in the military salute for a series of pictures, of photographs taken by an artist named Patricia Itzo. And as part of a larger movement to gain reparations from the military for these toxic exposures. And so there's something incredibly sort of forceful and moving in seeing these men being diagnosed with what has so vehemently been portrayed as a woman's disease, breast cancer, you know, in this kind of ironic salute, having been part of the military and, you know, served his country and at the same time been poisoned while doing so. And it's interesting to think, I think, also about gendered cancers in relation to this, because, you know, at the same time as we think of breast cancer being primarily a women's cancer, which it is, more men die of breast cancer than die of testicular cancer.
Interesting.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think of the toxic poison that was used during the Vietnam War, tons of it dumped, Agent Orange.
Yeah.
And finally, and the government and the military said, oh, it didn't cause any harm. Well, finally, it has been acknowledged after so many, many, many years. And that's another point that you bring out in the book, carcinogen. We have chemicals that have been developed, and in some ways it has blessed the environment, but in some ways it has created just horrible, horrible effects. They're seeing it in animals across the country. I remember a vet telling me when our beloved Scottish Terrier died from lymphoma, she was surprised. She'd never seen a little dog get it, but she's accustomed to seeing big dogs get it, and they usually were on farms where there were high levels of pesticides used. She said, it's very common. We see it among the big dogs. Well, people go on the big farms. They usually would have the bigger animals, the bigger dogs. And that just brought home something. We had, you know, had a toxic chemical applied, told that it was not toxic, it wouldn't hurt anything. But we're realizing now that that is something we've got to shift our thinking about. We have to realize that there are applications that we're utilizing of toxic substances that are going into our water, that are going into our foods. and in our lifestyle, products that we're using when we build our homes. All of this is having an effect, and it creates a breeding ground, if you will. It is a trigger. Would you disagree with me?
I completely disagree. I completely agree. And one of the things that I discuss in my book is how difficult it is, how there are so few infrastructures for us to be able to bring meaningful action against that. So one of the things to look at is do the law and how you what you can do if you've been exposed, say knowingly, like these men were, to carcinogens. And I look at a case that took place in Salinas in California, in which Firestone dumped chemicals illegally into the dump, and those contaminated the water supply. And several of the people nearby launched a suit saying, hey, we've been poisoned by this water. We have a much higher chance of getting cancer now than we would have if you hadn't illegally dumped your chemicals in our water supply. And I traced that legal suit, and it's really interesting. It went to the California Supreme Court. And at that point, you know, you have to bring the complaint since you don't actually have cancer yet. And by the time you'd have cancer, it would be very difficult to prove that it was because of the exposure you suffered years ago, because cancer is a disease that takes years often to manifest. Mm-hmm. And so they had to sue for something they called fear of cancer. So they had to argue that they felt anxiety and fear because they might get cancer. But what the court decided in that case was that they had to prove that they were more likely than not to get cancer because, you know, no one can tell who's going to get cancer from what. It's a very mm-hmm. mysterious disease that way. And the law doesn't like mystery. The law doesn't like uncertainty. They want to be able to say that this person caused this harm and should have to pay for that. It's very difficult. It's impossible to do that with cancer. So the law is judges said, well, you have to prove that you are more likely than not to get cancer from this exposure. Well, first of all, you could never prove that. You'd have to take 100 people and expose them and watch them for their lives and see if they got cancer. You could never prove that. But mm-hmm. secondly, more likely than not, that means you could cause cancer in 49 of 100 people and still not be more likely than not, you know, to mm-hmm. to have mm-hmm. cause cancer in this one person. So it's a very difficult situation where we don't have the institutional tools at our disposal to enforce this. And so this is one of the aspects that I find so interesting is, what do you do then in those situations of uncertainty? When you have an inkling that something is a carcinogen, it seems that those animals are not behaving and looking like they used to, but you can't prove with hard data or hard enough for the people making the regulations and the people on the other side of the debate that this is what's happening. And I think this is what we are in a situation of now. We have suspicions, we have a lot of data, but there are also powerful interests in on the other side of that, in manufacturing doubt, in continually sort of getting more and more detailed in trying to make us think that we're maybe more uncertain than we are. And that's one of the major problems in our ways of thinking about cancer and the ways we produce it and the ways we treat it in different ways.
I know I've done a number of interviews with different individuals that have done particular research on their own. And, for example, like cell towers, they're discovering it's affecting animals, different things. Without understanding, lots of times industries will explode and you can't see it, you can't smell it, you can't touch it, and yet the effects are quite pronounced. And yet there's a lot of information that's been hidden for years that is not brought out. It's almost like we've got so much information on one hand that is not being brought forward, and a tremendous lack or inability to demonstrate certain things via studies, et cetera, depending on what one's objective is with the study. you're right. We're caught in a catch-22. This has had such an impact on your life, Lachlan. Lachlan, I really would like to ask you a very personal question. For you, your book is just outstanding. It really is something that I think someone should sit and read and think about, because you offer so many different perspectives regarding the industries, the environments, the legal aspect that this can entail. It's just an incredibly valuable book. What would you say to someone that is dealing with this situation? You've dealt with it. You've gone through the malpractice. You have become an investigator in your own way. What would you say to my listeners today? What should they be cognizant of? What should they be attentive to? Is there something they can do?
There's so many things. One of the things I talk about is how I think, in part because of the kind of fear that you so eloquently raised, that we have around cancer, we use a lot of cliches to talk about it. We talk about the brave survivor and the personal battle and all that. And I think a lot of people who are in treatment can feel sometimes like they're not being seen in that. Like they're supposed to enact or perform some kind of character that they don't really feel. So I think one great place, you know, to start is to try and aim for some kind of communication that opens doors to more kinds of communication. And I think another thing is, I do think that we need to recognize the politics of the disease even as we're all living in it. And so one of the things I like to think of is, rather than thinking about marching for people with cancer or doing something for people with cancer on the political level, that we do things that try and bring visibility to the problem as a broader American problem. So we're marching as a way of getting attention to, you know, against BPA or against some other known carcinogen. So we bring attention to the structures that are causing cancer rather than the individual people who have it. Because I think when we bring attention to the individual people who have it, it's too easy to sentimentalize it. And it's too easy to make it into just a tragic personal story. And everything I'm writing about is trying to get cancer out of that realm and into a more public, political realm that I think it needs to be in if we're going to do anything about it.
And I think also being aware that there may be options to work with. Because what we're really talking about is an imbalance of chemistry. Now, that sounds very simplistic. But our body is a chemical manufacturing plant. Every living thing on this earth has a chemical manufacturing process. So when something causes that processing to go out of whack, we have to ask ourselves, what's the source? And for so many, there has been an awareness that it could be water, it could be a certain aspect of lifestyle, it could be a working environment. There are so many things, and it does take a mindfulness. It's a willingness to be open. And I think that your willingness to not just talk about your own experience, but to bring in many different paradigms of thought and observation. Your book, Malignant, How Cancer Becomes Us, is a very powerful read. And I think that it's something that we need to be alert to. And I think if we can look at something and say, all right, what are my options? What can I look at? What questions can I ask? How do I determine that I can get through whatever the challenge is? What do I do? All of those questions and more need to be looked at, and having an advocate that you can work with, a patient's advocate, I think is vitally important. And you're going to need a tough one, because most of the time, the systems that are in place don't want to get out of their particular modalities. If you'd like more information on this, the book itself you can get, but go to www.malignant.us, and that's U like unicorn, F like Frank, malignant.us. And Lachlan Jan, thank you so much for being my guest today. This has been a very important discussion, and I'm so pleased that you've dedicated your time to putting this information in written form so people can get to it.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you very much.
This is Donna Sebo. We're taking a break for just a moment. Malignant, How Cancer Becomes Us, Lachlan Jane. We're going to be back in just a moment.
Donna Sebo publishes a popular, inspirational, and insightful newsletter filled with information about her upcoming guests, her travel schedule, seminar presentations, and upbeat articles to lighten up your life. You can subscribe to this free monthly newsletter by emailing her at donna@delphiinternational.com. That's donna@delphiinternational.com. You can also go to her website, www.delphiinternational.com, and review past publications. Keep in touch with Donna through this monthly publication. Again, her email address is donna@delphiinternational.com, and her website is www.delphiinternational.com.
Good health is something all of us want to have. Being aware of what we eat, its nutritional value, and how to balance our physical needs with our busy schedules is always a challenge. Amino Muscle Snack Time goes a long way towards helping us meet this challenge. Amino Muscle Snack Time is a nutritional food product that is portable, tasty, and in chewable tablet form, vanilla and honey flavors, a bonus for maintaining a healthy amino acid balance for healthy muscles. Amino Muscle Snack Time can be used anytime, anywhere, first thing in the morning to kickstart your metabolism. Take 20 minutes before or after a workout to help recover and build muscle. Take mid-morning or mid-afternoon to help curb cravings for unhealthy snacks. Weight loss, appetite control. Only top of the line and no genetically modified ingredients are used, no caffeine added. These chewable tablets can be ordered through Amazon.com or SquatSponge.com. Take charge and jumpstart your food program by adding Amino Muscle Snack Time by visiting Amazon.com or SquatSponge.com for more information. Order now.
Hi, this is Donna. Welcome back. Telephone lines are now open, 888-627-6008. That's 888-627-6008. We have got a wonderful lineup of people coming up. We're going to be talking fashion, fashion, fashion with Tess Whitehurst. That's going to be on Monday. Magical Fashionista. Oh, that's going to be so much fun. Fall of the Alphas. Dana Arty. We're going to be discussing the business world and how things are changing. Are they really? Well, we're going to find out. Safe Beyond Belief. Margaret Johnston is my guest on Message Zach Friend. We're going to be finding out more about how we have the power to change certain things and Sacred Journey of the Heart. Rana Prince is going to be my guest. We've got a great lineup of people this month. Tell your friends, and you know you can always check on who's coming up on the show. Just come right into where we are and get on show information, and you'll find out the details that you need. Yesterday, I had started to share a wonderful story with you about a cat. His name is Luke. And I started to share it, and I ran out of time. So I wanted to be sure that I better start it over again, because there may have been some of you that didn't listen yesterday. So bear with me, those of you that have heard part of the story, because I want to finish it today. Now, Luke had belonged to a wonderful woman. Oh, he's just such a gorgeous cat. And he just loved her and was happy as he could be. However, Luke's mistress was an elderly lady. She ended up having to go into a nursing home, and then she passed away. And Luke finds himself in a shelter. Well, here is an animal that has had nothing but love all of its life in an environment that, for all the care and the concerns of the people that work in shelters, they have so many animals to take care of. They can't give much time to anyone. Well, Luke's story is an interesting one because they just absolutely adored him. And fortunately, he would eat, but he was melancholy, and He would at the shelter. There'd be people to come in and look at different animals, and some of those animals would go home, of course, not all of them. And whenever anybody came in, he'd always go to the front of the cage. The caretaker said he was always there, always on stage. He wanted to get out of the shelter. He wanted to go home. Nobody even stopped to look at him. What would happen? The shelter workers noticed he'd go back to his cage, put his head on his paws, and he had this melancholy look and feel about him. And the weeks went by. Didn't look like Luke was going to be going to anyone's home anytime soon. However, the day before Luke was supposed to be euthanized, there was one of the workers at the shelter, and she said, "This is such a special cat. I've got to be able to do something." So she posted a Facebook of, "Please help Luke," put his picture up, and a woman by the name of Cassie was going through her Facebook feed when she saw this picture of this cat. As it turns out, the worker at the shelter was a friend of Cassie's. And she said, "Oh my goodness, Luke is gorgeous." So she sent a note to her friend saying, "I'll take him." There was a challenge with it. Shelter workers were just delighted that someone wanted to take Luke. They all loved him. But they had a situation. What was that situation? They had to figure out a way to get Luke to Cassie's home, which was 1,200 miles away from where he was housed. So there is an underground railroad rescued kitty network. Have you ever heard of it? I hadn't heard of it. Now, this is what happened. Now, keep in mind, Cassie lives in Montana, and Luke is in, I believe it was Arizona. This is what happened to bring around the Underground Railroad Rescued Kitty Network. There was a realtor, Tina LeBlanc, and she had come into the U.S. from Germany, and she had had a personal experience herself where an airline had lost her kitty. And she said, "Oh, I've got to be able to prevent this from happening to anybody else." So Tina created the Underground Railroad Rescued Kitty Network. And its abbreviation is URRKN, if you'd like to find out more about it. And what she did, she decided her mission was uniting cats with their new adopted families. So she would choose routes. She asked friends to form a relay team, and they would chauffeur the kitty by car for a couple of hours to a certain stop, and then someone else would take over. Do you know people signed up to do this? They were so excited to be a part of this railroad rescue, and they would do this on weekends when most people were not on the job. They paid for their own gas and tolls, and each of these people that were a part of this Kitty Railroad System Network, they were determined that that cat would have a way to get to its new home. By golly, do you know within 2 hours after they linked up with this Underground Railroad Rescued Kitty Network, that beautiful cat, Luke, was in his new home. And this is an amazing story. Now, if you'd like more information on this, you can go to URRKN, and you can use facebook.com/URRKN. And there's also another group called Imagine Home and Your Daily Cute. Then also, you've got a Dog Rescue Railroad, and there's a Yahoo group, and there's a Dogster Railroad forum on Dogster, Dogster.com. I'm telling you, there are some amazing people out there that solve problems that would otherwise seem insurmountable. Luke has a beautiful home and a team of people. It took the teamwork to make it happen. This is Donna Sebo. Have an utterly magnificent weekend wherever you are on this fabulous planet of ours. Remember always, you're the master of your fate. You are the captain of your soul. God bless. I'll be back with you on Monday. Same time, same place. Bye for now.
You've been listening to The Donna Sebo Show. We're delighted that you were able to join us and invite you to tell your friends and family about the program. Have a wonderful day.